This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Sudan's government has made a tentative agreement with rebel groups to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court.
We're also, emphasizing that, we understand that the ICC is a necessary component of a broader program of transitional justice.
Also, late former Kenyan President Daniel Arap Moi was buried on his estate today. Plus, talks on the controversial Nile Dam project resume, and the African Union summit has wrapped up. We'll have these stories on and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Sudanese citizens are reacting to the agreement by Sudan's transitional government and Darfuri rebel groups to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir and three others accused of crimes against humanity in the country's western Darfur region to the International Criminal Court. Yesterday, during peace negotiations in Juba, South Sudan, the parties said they would cooperate with the court, which first indicted the men more than 10 years ago. Some Khartoum residents welcomed the decision as last year's revolution in Sudan, which toppled al-Bashir, included justice along with peace and freedom as its main themes. Many Sudanese say that true reconciliation in their war-torn country will only take place when victims see that perpetrators of human rights abuses face justice. Michael Atit has the details for VOA from Khartoum.
Nahed Jabralla, a Sudanese rights activist who works for the national NGO SEMA in Khartoum, praised the transitional government and the Darfur armed groups for showing courage by agreeing to hand over Bashir and three of his former officials to the ICC. She says thousands of Sudanese families have been waiting for this for a long time.
This is very important to reach justice for women in Darfur, and to stand for women who faced and facing till now the rape and other violations. So we are happy for this step.
Jabralla says she would like to see more concrete steps taken by the transitional government to implement the decision to hand over the four men to the ICC. She says, by ensuring that Bashir and others are tried in the Hague, Sudan will prove to the world that it is committed to protecting human rights in the country. Speaking in Arabic, Murtada Salah, a resident of Al Janina town in West Darfur state, says by phone that handing over Bashir and other suspects to the ICC will help heal the trauma that victims have faced for years.
This is very important to all of us as Sudanese, and all incidents which have been happening since the beginning of the war in Darfur in 2003 have caused sufferings to the people. So what I see is that if they are handed over to the court, it will be good.
Hashim Abubakar works as a legal advocate in Khartoum. Speaking in Arabic, Abubakar says handing over Bashir to the ICC might have a negative impact on the political situation in Sudan, and argues that Bashir's supporters could try to cause insecurity by protesting against the move.
This decision would have some political and security implications on the country, and I'm quite sure that politicians, tribe mates and professional supporters of those accused within the whole Sudan would not just keep silent on this matter.
Speaking in Arabic to reporters last evening in Juba, Muhammad Hassan Ataishi, a member of the government's negotiation team, says the government is committed to fulfilling its promises made to the Sudanese during the revolution.
Our conviction as government, which made us to agree to allow those who have been issued arrest warrants to be taken before the International Criminal Court. This decision is based on the principle of justice, which is one of the themes of the revolution, and based on the principle of no impunity.
Bashir and the three other men face charges for crimes against humanity and genocide committed in Darfur. For VOA News, I am Michael Latit in Khartoum.
For more on this development in Sudan, Human Rights Watch senior researcher Jahan Henry spoke to me earlier today from Khartoum to explain what this decision means for justice in Sudan and the world.
So basically what happened yesterday is one of the officials of the Sovereign Council made a statement in the context of peace talks happening in Juba right now, to the effect that the parties agreed that the ICC would be a one part of sort of a four-pronged approach to transitional justice for Darfur, and that in that respect, that the government would cooperate with the ICC, and that the people who are suspects would appear before the court. So that is the statement, and we sought clarification today and heard in meetings both from the head of the Sovereign Council, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and also in another meeting with the Prime Minister Hamdok, that indeed the government does intend to cooperate with the ICC. However, the details of that cooperation have not been made public yet, or may not have been decided as yet. It appears to be that they reaffirmed the commitment that Al-Taishi made yesterday in Juba, but that details haven't really been spelled out yet. So that's where things stand. We think that's very positive, and that such sort of commitment to the ICC and to cooperating with the court and to being in touch with the court to work out modalities is absolutely the right thing for this government to say, because it signals, you know, a real turning of the page on this legacy of impunity in Sudan. So we've been welcoming these statements, but it is true that the details are not clear yet. I think a lot of things need to be decided, and this will happen best through conversation, direct conversation between the government and the ICC to figure out, you know, in what manner things will occur and how people will be appearing before the court.
And so one of the big questions after yesterday or during yesterday was the issue of the civilian side of the Sudanese government and the military side of the Sudanese government. But it sounds like you've spoken to both sides, and both sides are actually committing to this cooperation, whatever that might entail.
Exactly. Today, both civilian and at the head of the Sovereign Council's military, both men reaffirmed the government's commitment to cooperating with the ICC, but didn't spell out details. I think there is a clear understanding that this requires communicating with the ICC directly, and both offices talked about that communication. So we are hopeful that that's going to happen very soon, if it's not already happening, and that a strategy will be put in place. We're also, emphasizing that we understand that the ICC is a necessary component of a broader sort of program of transitional justice. It's not the only piece of it. It's a very small piece of it in some ways, but it is a necessary piece of it. And we think that is a shared. We think that's also how the government is seeing it.
Last question. You've talked about how this is, you know, a turning of the page for Sudan itself. What about for Africa generally, or even for the world? This has been one of the most high-profile cases for the ICC. Obviously, the ICC has come under a lot of pressure from governments around the world, particularly in Africa, over the last few years. What does this mean globally for international justice?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I think the ICC, it's definitely been a huge case in the history of that court. It's been pending for a long time. The Sudanese government under al-Bashir's rule was expert at evading justice. I think it would be hugely significant for justice on the regional and international stage to have this cooperation move forward. Certainly the people in Darfur who were most affected by the crimes there, they've been holding this in their minds for all this time, and they've been holding out hopes for this all this time. So for them, obviously, this is an opportunity to to see finally some results after all this waiting and all of these statements and all of these demands and all of their efforts.
That was Human Rights Watch senior researcher Jahan Henry speaking to me from Khartoum, Sudan, earlier today. Daniel Arap Moi, Kenya's longest ruling president, was given a 19-gun salute as he was buried today next to the grave of his wife on his sprawling estate in Kenya's Rift Valley. His coffin was flown by military helicopter early in the morning before a gun carriage transferred it into a large tent for a religious service and speeches by politicians. Moi, who died last week at 95, leaves behind a mixed legacy. His tenure was marked by brutal autocratic rule, including torture, extrajudicial killings, and rampant corruption that has become endemic in Kenya. But he also oversaw a transition to multi-party elections before stepping down from power. Reuters quoted Deputy President William Ruto at the funeral telling mourners that Moi said that tribalism is stupidity. Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia will resume the talks tomorrow regarding the construction of the controversial Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with former assistant to the Egyptian foreign minister and expert on the Nile Basin, Mohamed Higazi.
I think this, among the other remaining points, will settle the question for good. And I'm waiting for the suggested meeting on the 13th and the 14th of this month. And this will definitely bring us to the final stage where a legal agreement should be signed between the parties. This will settle definitely Egypt's worries. And it will help also creating the expected regional development approach to see the region moving further and moving up from a nationalistic, limited point of view to a larger regional approach where the three dams can be harmonized together as the agreement stipulates.
But some Egyptian analysts expressed some concerns about loose language that could open the door for possible disagreements. Is that a valid argument?
If the three parties understood the importance of cooperation for them and how water can be a cooperative framework, or how can water be a reason of coordination. So the language used is quite sufficient from a technical and legal point of view. The political willingness of the three countries, I'm sure, are there. The third party intervention, I mean the United States, up till President Trump's interest in following up the file himself and meeting the parties, all are indications that really suggest that we have to trust each other, because out of many years of studying the river and comparing the integrated approach of planning to all international rivers, one can really not only dream of seeing a scheme of cooperation, as the Treasury statement said, but a regional approach to develop. So we will have a legal binding document, and with a political support and with international supervision and with the support of the World Bank and the Treasury, introducing to the three countries a scheme of cooperation where we can link the power grids. Egypt and Sudan are very close to complete their power grids. Why not with the Renaissance Dam, which electricity can be used in the markets of Sudan and Egypt and then exported to the regional Gulf market or further to Europe? We can talk about roadways and railways as well. So Ethiopia, as a landlocked country, can use the Mediterranean ports of Egypt in Alexandria and elsewhere. One has to be cautiously optimistic. However, all indications to me is that if we want to help the river ecosystem, if we want to help the people economy in the three countries, we have to embark on a regional framework where water security will not be decided by national aspiration only, but regional aspiration. Maybe welcome such efforts and hope the three countries will sign by the end of the month an agreement, a legal binding agreement, which will settle all the worries of all parties, and it will respect the right of Ethiopia to develop the Nile and for Sudan to regulate the river and for Egypt to maintain its historic right in water.
That was Mohamed Higazi, who is an expert on Nile Basin issues and is also a former assistant to the Egyptian foreign minister, speaking to my colleague Mohamed El-Shanawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15, 580, and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The African Union finished its annual summit in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia this week, and the theme is silencing the guns. But can the continental body help end wars in Libya, Burkina Faso, and elsewhere? International Crisis Group's Director of African Regional Advocacy, Alyssa Jobson, was just in Addis Ababa and spoke to me earlier today from Nairobi.
So silencing the guns is one of the big themes. It's the African Union theme for the year. A pledge was made in 2013 to try and silence the guns by 2020. Obviously, that was an enormous ask, not something that would be possible to do, whether in Africa or elsewhere. But I think this year the African Union wants to focus on trying to move forward and trying to reach a point where some of the conflicts are, well, at least where they're engaging more on some of the conflicts. So I think one of the big outcomes that we've seen is that there is likely to be an extraordinary summit specifically on silencing the guns in May, which I think will likely be in South Africa. So that's one big step forward. I mean, for the crisis grouping, I think one of the things that we've been seeing in recent years is that, you know, there seems to have been a reduction of interest, I think, amongst heads of state to work collectively on peace and security. Peace and security hasn't been getting the amount of attention that it has done in the past at AU summits. You know, always the Peace and Security Council would meet at summit level. This year they did, but it's no longer a given. And a number of states are sort of wanting to work more unilaterally or work more in regional groupings than use the African Union. So I think it's good to see a re-emphasis on this. And, you know, it's something that South Africa has really taken hold of.
Now,
in terms of peace and security, two issues that have been high on the agenda are Libya, where the AU is seeking a greater role, and also the Sahel.
And so looking specifically at those two, can you go into a bit about Libya? There's been a lot of diplomacy in Russia, in Europe, regarding Libya, and so far it hasn't really achieved much at all. Can the AU do better?
I don't think the AU can do better on its own. I think it can. I think it can have a role. At the moment, it hasn't defined what that is, and it needs to do so. I mean, Libya is a, you know, it's a really crowded space, and we've got really big powers that are engaged and you know, sort of playing in Libya. So the AU really needs to define what its comparative advantage is, and it hasn't done so yet. I'm not convinced that it's managed to do that at this summit. So I think if the AU is going to have a role and is going to be effective, then it does need to decide what it wants to do and how it can. How it can fit into that big jigsaw of other players.
And then what about the Sahel? There's been really over the last few years, but especially in the last year or two, there's been just an explosion of violence there, particularly in Burkina Faso.
As you say, the Sahel is a big priority, and especially Burkina Faso. That's, it's something that we've been asking the African Union to engage in, and particularly this year, we've really called on it to really focus on Burkina Faso. There's a proposal being discussed at the moment about potentially sending a force into to support the G5. Five states that have been affected by jihadism over the last few years. And they've been working together to try and push back jihadist groups. It's not had a great deal of success. And I think that the AU would like to try and support the constituent members of the G5.
And so they might actually put together a force. Would that be similar to AMISOM, which is in Somalia?
It's not clear. This is, at the moment, just under discussion. And there aren't really that many details surfacing as to what the force would look like. At the moment, the language that's in the draft decision is around the African Standby Force and standing that up in connection with ECOWAS, the West African regional grouping.
That was Alyssa Jobson of the International Crisis Group speaking to me earlier from Nairobi. Zimbabwe's cash-strapped government is moving to raid exporters' foreign currency balances in a move seen as an attempt to shore up its dry coffers. VOA's Eddie Gondo has the story.
Zimbabwe's central bank issued a circular to authorized dealers this week, instructing them to liquidate all foreign currency that will be channeled into the country via their banks after the prescribed three-month period. The circular stipulates that exporters shall forfeit the expected retention portion of their export proceeds through the liquidation of such funds at the prevailing interbank market rate in exchange for the dropping local currency. Currently, exporters can retain 50-80% of foreign currency after exporting. According to Zimstats, Zimbabwe's exports account for 60% of the foreign exchange inflows into the country, totaling US $4.5 billion. Tendai Biti, who chairs the Public Accounts Committee in Parliament, which supervises the Reserve Bank's operations, criticized the bank's plan.
The whole idea and the whole practice of the Reserve Bank expropriating export surrender requirements is unlawful and unconstitutional.
Biti says there is no enabling legislation for the move, calling it expropriation of private property and largely punitive.
First, there's a rule of law that you cannot take punitive action without giving an individual the right to be heard. And we all know that in the process of trade, delays will take place which have nothing to do with the exporter or the importer.
Observers say government's policy directives are one of the country's biggest sources of macroeconomic instability. They say it is an indication that the central bank's coffers are empty. Economic analyst Gift Ngano says the government directive is a sign of desperation that will negatively impact the private sector.
Yes. When you are saying someone must liquidate in 3 months, you are forcing me as an exporter to have unnecessary expenditure for the sake of saving my foreign currency. Because purchasing is with a cycle, and the consumption of the foreign currency is with a cycle. It's not a small transaction where
Zimbabwe is experiencing excruciating foreign currency shortages, which are choking industry and government operations. Government says importing key commodities such as fuel, pharmaceuticals, medicines, grain, and electricity requires foreign exchange. Mugano says the central bank wants access to exporters' foreign exchange earnings and possibly to curb hoarding of money, while some sectors require the same amount of money. Mugano gives an example of the mining sector, which he says contributes 60% of total export earnings.
So I think it's a balancing act, and what is required is dialogue. I think they need to dialogue. The central bank has no reserves of foreign currency, so they want to make sure they put foreign currency available, which can be offloaded into the interbank to stabilize the exchange rate. And I think they want to use this money to make it available for those who want money in the interbank. But the challenge is that what the central bank needs to understand, the one who makes foreign currency need the foreign currency to generate more foreign currency.
Government has been accused of relying more and more on punitive directives to show up its finances and raising fees for its services across the board, even though household incomes have not increased. They say the populace is feeling the weight of an incompetent government that is saddled with corruption and macroeconomic policy volatility. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
That wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thanks to our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Sidrak Franklin. And thank you for choosing the Voice of America.